Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations on breast cancer from the 2024 ASCO Annual Meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Priyanka Sharma from the University of Kansas Cancer Center in Westwood, Kansas, and to begin, she commented on a presentation at ASCO from the RxPONDER or SWOG-1007 trial.
Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Priyanka Sharma. I'm professor of medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. And today I am going to talk to you all about some key takeaways from 2024 ASCO Annual Meeting. So the first section that I will cover relates to hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. This first abstract is by Kalinsky et al. The investigators here looked at serum anti-Müllerian hormone or AMH levels in the RxPONDER or SWOG-1007 trial and noted that AMH refines identification of premenopausal women in this trial who are more likely to benefit from chemotherapy. So for this project, they limited to patients who are less than 55 years of age and self-reported premenopausal, which was about a little over 1,000 women in the study. For those of us who are not endocrinologists or reproductive endocrinologists, we had to learn about AMH and inhibin B, and these are actually markers of diminished ovarian reserve that are commonly used in reproductive endocrinology workup. The assays in the table outlined on the left were the ones that were studied in RxPONDER, E2, progesterone, LH, FSH, AMH, and inhibin B. And out of all of these, AMH was the most robust predictor of menopausal status. 21% of premenopausal women less than 55 years of age actually had AMH levels in the postmenopausal range. And you can see on the table on the bottom right that the proportion of women that had low AMH levels that were quote premenopausal went up as the age went up. So in women under 45, only about 3% had low AMH levels, whereas in women who are between 50 to 54, over half had AMH levels that were in postmenopausal range. On multivariable analysis, the pretreatment serum AMH level predicted chemotherapy benefit in premenopausal women less than 55 years of age. And you can see inhibin B also shows some trend, but AMH was a more robust predictor. The Kaplan-Meier curves on the right shows this in terms of the IDFS. You can see the women that had low AMH levels, which is about 21% of patients, had no difference in five-year IDFS with chemotherapy or chemoendocrine therapy. In other words, chemotherapy didn't add to outcomes in these women, whereas in women who had medium or high AMH levels, there was a 7.8% improvement in five-year IDFS. So in our RxPONDER trial, among premenopausal women who were less than 55 years of age, 20% had actually low pretreatment serum AMH levels, indicating that based on AMH, these women were actually postmenopausal. And AMH was a better indicator of adjuvant chemotherapy benefit than the reported menopausal status, age, or other serum hormone levels. And those with low AMH levels did not benefit from chemotherapy. The investigators reported that they're planning to validate these findings in 300 patients that were enrolled on the Unicancer study along with the RxPONDER study, and low serum AMH levels could aid in identification of premenopausal patients who can safely forego adjuvant chemotherapy, especially in situations where menopausal status is unclear. So one could have a situation where a woman has undergone a hysterectomy in her 40s, still retains their ovaries, so doesn't really have regular menstrual cycles, and we don't really know what her menopausal status is. She presents with breast cancer at age 48. Word of caution, though, commercial AMH assays cannot be interchanged. So one cannot use the assay that this trial looked at and apply it to any other commercial assay that's out there. All the assays have different lower limits of detection and thresholds. The research assay that was used in this analysis has good correlation with the Arup commercial assay, and the investigators actually presented that data during the presentation. And the assay can actually also be sent to University of Kansas, which is where all the central testing was done.
So, you know, this is so interesting. First of all, do people use this type of assay to figure out in general whether, say, a woman who's on an LHRH agonist is adequately suppressed? Is that what they use now? Because I thought it was like FSH.
Yes. So no, it's not really us oncologists haven't really been using right. this assay, but it is used in reproductive endocrinology to identify, you know, to relate with ovarian reserve and how likely a woman is to have a successful reproductive endocrinology process or procedure, based on the AMH levels. But it is a pretty good indicator of ovarian reserve and hence an indicator of how close a woman is to menopause. So the lower the level, especially if it's below the lower limit of detection, the woman is at menopause.
So you know, getting back to this actual study, though, do you think this is something that, say, you or other people, or other investigators might actually use? Because, you know, kind of, to me, it like seems like it supports the fact that chemo is working through ovarian, you know, ablation or suppression. And I don't know if you're one of the people who offers ovarian suppression instead of chemo to patients, or if you are, then I'm not sure why this would matter.
So, the important thing is for in our responder, the benefit of chemo was only noted in premenopausal women with 1-3 positive nodes. So in postmenopausal women, you know, it's to me, it's a lot more important first to determine who's postmenopausal, right? So if a patient presents at age, let's say 48 with breast cancer, and she's had a hysterectomy in the past, she retains her ovaries, doesn't really have any menopausal symptoms, we don't really know if she's pre or postmenopausal, right? So if this woman is postmenopausal and has one positive node, I don't need to even have a discussion of chemo or ovarian function suppression with her, right? So it is very important for me to know whether this 48 or 50-year-old person is pre or postmenopausal. I can check E2 and FSH levels, but those fluctuate based on where you are in your cycle, right? So if you're not really having menstrual cycles, we don't know where you are, and those might not be reliable. So that's a situation I would use it first to figure out who's postmenopausal, because there I can safely forego chemotherapy and not worry about it. Now, if this person is premenopausal based on my testing, then we have the complex discussion of chemo versus ovarian function suppression, how much benefit each or the other has, and of course, the opportunity to participate in the offset trial, which is asking this question in a prospective fashion. So determining the menopausal status in these borderline age groups is quite important, because the chemo decision is highly dependent on it.
So I would like to interject something that not necessarily related to this paper, but it is related to ER positivity and maybe to genomic assays like the Oncotype assay. Something I only became aware of, maybe I'm the last person to realize this, but I started to see a couple papers on so-called ER low. I've been hearing, you know, obviously you've heard about HER2 low forever, but now I see ER low. And I'm starting to realize that if ER low really means triple negative, that's a very different therapy. And like I said, I don't know if I'm the last one to figure this out or not, but what is an oncologist supposed to do if they get an ER assay back of 5%? And would an assay like the, you know, Oncotype help?
So, I mean, Oncotype is highly dependent on ER genes, right? So it does give you an expression of that. And ASCO-CAP actually, I think it's about 3 years ago, introduced this category of ER low 1 to 10%, recognizing that the benefit of endocrine therapy in the patients in this subgroup is very unclear. At the same time, these patients are typically excluded from triple negative trials because those require typically the strict 0% threshold. So they kind of fall behind in all categories. If you have a ER of 5% and a patient's presenting at the initial diagnosis with a tumor size that meets criteria of preoperative therapy, let's say ER and PR are 4 and 5% and HER2 is negative, I tend to treat this person preoperatively as a triple negative patient and give them the benefit of chemoimmunotherapy. And if they have residual disease, I think it makes sense to retest the ER in that setting. If it's all 0-0, then perhaps the initial findings were not very reliable. If it stays the same and it goes up closer to 10%, then one could be inclined to recommend endocrine therapy with the caveat that we don't know how much benefit it has. A lot of investigators have done molecular profiling of these ER low, and about 80% of them have the similar profiling like triple negative, the basals, but not all. So I think within this small subgroup, there is heterogeneity, but they're very poorly represented in clinical trials because they get excluded from kind of both types.
Actually, Joyce O'Shaughnessy the other day said exactly what you did. And that was like, I was like, I said, am I the last person to hear this? Because I'm not sure other people are as aware of it. I know it's maybe not that common, but, you know, it's certainly not rare. And I really wonder whether people are aware that you all are doing. She told me that there's some little bit of data showing you see pretty good path CRs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have a couple of trials where we expanded up to 10%, and the PAT CR rates are the same as the true triple negatives. In fact, the germline BRCA carrier rates are about the same as the true triple negatives. So I tend to. It's not a small number. It's about 15%. So it's
interesting.
You know, the regular clinicians do see it on not that uncommonly.
Can I throw in one more RX Ponder thing before you go into the next paper? I saw that you were on some of these papers.
Yes.
There was a bunch of stuff that came out at ASCO that I thought was super cool. I don't think we gave it to you to look at, but I was looking at it before I came in here, and which looked at data from RX Ponder, and I didn't realize this is a great chance to look at the impact of chemo versus endocrine therapy, right? So you had a paper looking at, I think, fatigue and I think cognitive issues and all. I thought that was incredible. Any overall take that you came away with from that?
So a lot of that work is still ongoing. I think there's going to be many important learnings from the translational work that come from the tissue and blood. So this is one of the first blood analysis to be presented. Yara Abdu presented a small sub-study from racial disparities and also differences in how the different aspects of the Oncotype DX, the different gene scores of the Oncotype DX relate to racial differences and outcomes. And
wow.
There's some distinct differences between African-Americans, Asians, and whites in terms of what's up and what's down. So it's a very large trial. So we hope to learn a lot more from it than just, you know, which patients benefited from chemotherapy versus not.
One thing I was trying to figure out, because I've always been curious about, like, is there a chemo brain and what's it from? Is it biologic or from the experience or whatever? And so I guess it's not a perfect way to look at it, but I guess you all did look at it. Again, anything that you came away there, do you think the people who got chemo had more cognitive issues there?
I think a lot of studies show that if you take the endocrine therapy out of it, the cognitive effects from chemotherapy over 6 months or 12 months even out, right? So it's a lot more complex. And the contribution of chemo when we add all of those other things is where the complexity arises, right? When you add endocrine therapy over in function suppression, premature menopause, and that's where I'm not sure that this particular study had the right types of assessments in the right types of patients at the right times to get to that question. These get to be very hard studies to do. I mean, there's lots of other things like, you know, whether a person has a significant other, is married, who else they have in their household. There's lots of things that have an impact, understandably so. And we try to support our patients the best we can as they go through some of these changes.
And there's also the other way of trying to assess something, which is ask a person like you, based on your experience, what you've read, et cetera, I mean, I would imagine going through chemotherapy would have a lot of effects on a lot of, you know, mental processes, stress, et cetera, et cetera. But do you think that beyond that, any of the chemotherapeutic agents actually have some kind of cognitive effect on people?
I mean, I think the data is there on both sides. And as you rightfully pointed out, is it the drugs? Is it the medical condition? Is it everything else that goes along with it that has an impact? Is the hardest thing to tease apart. And we seem to have more of this in breast cancer, I think because of anti-estrogen therapy. We know those drugs certainly have an impact, right? In terms of women going through menopause certainly complain of cognitive issues, even if they don't have, right, breast cancer. And so that definitely has an impact. And whether that settles over time or people get adjusted to it and alter their lifestyle and, you know, stop multitasking, stop doing five. I often tell my patients that are going through chemotherapy, like, you're having to remember 30 extra things right now related to your treatment. So it's okay if you forget some things, because there's only so much each one of us can remember. So some of it's just adjustment to, you know, those things. But it certainly seems to be a more of a problem for our breast cancer patients than I see in other solid tumors or other colleagues talk about in curable settings. So is this something that our patients face on a day-to-day basis, and we have to come up with better ways to help them get through it?
All right, let's talk about RS Clin.
So this is the second set of data that came out of our Xponder, actually included SWOG-8814 in addition to our Xponder. So RS Clin tool has been available to use for patients with node negative hormone positive breast cancer. And this tool integrates the recurrence score and other clinical pathological variables to give a little bit more individualized risk of prognosis in an individual patient that can be used for counseling and also decision about, you know, how much benefit chemotherapy is going to be there. So this RS Clin node positive tool is an attempt to expand that tool to now patients with node positive disease. So this data included a little over 1,600 premenopausal patients from RXponder with 1 to 3 positive nodes, and little over 3,600 postmenopausal patients. The postmenopausal patients came from RXponder and SWOG-8814. SWOG-8814 was a trial only for postmenopausal women and actually included patients with 3+ positive nodes also. The validation cohort for this particular analysis was the CLELITE registry that had almost 600 patients. So what they noted was the RS Clin node positive tool provided more prognostic information than recurrence score alone or the clinical pathological models alone, both in pre- and postmenopausal women. And in the external validation, the risk estimates derived from RS Clin node positive were concordant with the observed risks. In postmenopausal women, the recurrence score showed interaction with chemotherapy benefit, but the absolute benefit from chemotherapy increased only after the recurrence score got above 25. In premenopausal women with the recurrence score of less than 25, there was no interaction between recurrence score and chemotherapy benefit, and chemotherapy benefit was seen across all recurrence score levels, which is what we know from our Xponder trial. Couple of caveats. The estimates from the RS Clin node positive are limited to IDFS and do not provide separate estimates for distant recurrences. Remember, the IDFS includes contralateral events, death from other causes as well. The model may overestimate IDFS risk in general contemporary population because the patients in RXponder and 8814 did not receive what we would consider now to be modern endocrine therapy with AIs, CDK inhibitors, or ovarian function suppressions. And the chemotherapy used in these trials was also not the fourth generation chemotherapy for all patients. Also, another caveat is for premenopausal women, the RS Clin node positive tool would be applicable only to those with 0 to 25 recurrence score, because those are the only women included in RXponder. With the caveats on the side, I do think that this tool is helpful in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer with 1 to 3 positive nodes to give us a more individualized prognosis based on combination of both our recurrence score and clinical pathological risk features, and also give idea about absolute chemotherapy benefit, which can aid in shared decision making. This tool is not yet available to use, but should be available sometime later this year.
That's really awesome, though, that this work has been done. I'm kind of curious, you know, thinking back to the adjuvant online model that was out there in the past, where it seemed like what I saw was like people would use it for a couple of years and they got to know the numbers and they didn't use it anymore. Do you yourself use RS Clin?
I do. And it's quite helpful as you get through different clinical risk, right? So you could have a recurrence score of 20 in a premenopausal patient with a tumor size of 1.2 centimeters, but you can have the same recurrence score of 20 with a tumor size of now 3.2 centimeters and a grade 2 tumor instead of grade 1 tumor, the prognosis differs a lot. The absolute chemotherapy benefit will differ a lot. So it helps in individual decision making with the patient. So I do use the other one a lot, and I will use the positive one when it's available. Not to decide who should or should not take chemotherapy, but I think the numbers that are more individual help both the patient and us in the shared decision making.
Absolutely. When we get to the end of this and I tell you about one of these abstracts, it relates to how patients look at absolute benefits. But I've got to throw out to you one of my chronic questions I've been asking for like about 10 years, but I don't think I've asked you, which is, do you ever use a genomic assay like Oncotype in the neoadjuvant situation? I hear so many cases of people with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, they have big tumors, they get chemo, it doesn't affect them at all. And I always wondered why people didn't use it more in that setting. Do you ever use it that way?
I do. And in fact, MammaPrint is used much more in the neoadjuvant setting than this, and Oncotype is used too. So in situations where I clearly have made a decision of chemotherapy without anything else, if somebody is presenting with N2, N3 disease and locally advanced disease, the decision is made. But in any other situation, if I need a genomic tool to make a decision of chemotherapy, I feel like I can use it neoadjuvantly or adjuvantly. It's the same assay. It gives me the same information about what systemic therapy to use. So if, you know, let's say it's a 60-year-old premenopausal patient with clinically N1 disease and, you know, a 4-centimeter tumor, she would want to get breast conservation. So it'd be nice if we can shrink it. And so I'll do a genomic test. If this indicates need for chemotherapy, we'll do that. But if it indicates no need for chemotherapy, then we might do 4 to 6 months of endocrine therapies to help her get to breast conservation. So I use it.
But I mean, incidentally, would you do that in a premenopausal woman, endocrine therapy, neoadjuvant?
So in a premenopausal woman that has node negative disease, where we would rely on genomic tests to make decisions about chemotherapy, yes. Like if it's a premenopausal patient, again, with a 3.5-4 centimeter tumor, they would desire breast conservation, and you'd want to do something to shrink it. I don't want to just give chemotherapy without knowing, right, whether this person will ever need or benefit from chemotherapy. So a genomic test there is certainly very helpful. There's actually a SWOG trial, SWOG 2206, that's ongoing, that relies on the genomic assay MammaPrint and identification of MammaPrint high 2 risk patients to randomize patients to chemo versus chemoimmunotherapy. So for that trial, all of that testing is being done on biopsy samples, yes.
What I was curious about was, would you use neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in a premenopausal woman who wanted breast conservation?
So I think the neoadjuvant endocrine therapy data in premenopausal women is less robust than postmenopausal women to be able to achieve something, right? To be able to achieve enough reduction. What would you do? Just tamoxifen alone, or would you try to ovarian function suppress them and give an endocrine therapy? The neoadjuvant endocrine therapy data is a lot more robust in postmenopausal women. So I haven't personally used neoadjuvant endocrine therapy in a premenopausal patient to get to breast conservation.
Just out of curiosity, if you could, you know, I always ask these weird questions, and the patient really was very, very interested. Would you give ovarian suppression, AI, and CDK?
If the patient had no negative disease and otherwise didn't meet criteria for adjuvant CDK, I wouldn't just use it off trial in a neoadjuvant setting. I think I would have trouble getting it approved in the first place, but it would be a good clinical trial.
I thought there is some data in the CDK in the neoadjuvant setting.
Right, there's a couple of big trials, both primarily in postmenopausal women. But that would be a reasonable question to ask in a clinical trial. There's also some thought process that in these borderline risk categories where the genomic testing is in borderline category, like, you know, Oncotype of between 16 and, you know, 24, you know, could the CDK4/6 inhibitor serve the purpose of chemotherapy even in low clinical risk situations where they don't necessarily meet the criteria for quote, adjuvant CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy? So that's a right. That's a very, very good question to ask under clinical trial umbrella.
Yeah, that would be interesting. All right, well, let's go on to the number one favorite topic of the research to practice chat room.
ctDNA. So this data was presented from the Monarch E study on the prognostic utility of ctDNA in the Monarch E trial. As we know, Monarch E was the adjuvant trial that established the efficacy of adjuvant Abema and led to the approval of Abema in patients with high-risk hormone receptor-positive disease. This was a biomarker cohort of the trial that included a little over 900 patients. It was a combined patient across both arms, so they're not separated by arm. The blood was collected prior to study at 3, 6, and 24 months. Not everybody had all the sequential blood levels collected. The ctDNA was done by the tumor-informed Signatera assay, the biomarker group that was selected to be enriched for IDFS events. Overall, the biomarker group has a slightly poor outcome than the entire trial population, but that was by design of this biomarker study. Besides the higher IDFS, the biomarker group and the ITT group had baseline similar characteristics. At baseline, 8% of patients had ctDNA positivity, and among patients who were baseline ctDNA negative, 10% became positive on treatment during these longitudinal testing. And among patients who were positive at baseline, which was 8% of total, 59% remained persistently positive on treatment. So baseline ctDNA detection was associated with the worst outcome. None of us were surprised by seeing this because we've seen this in many other smaller studies. Patients with ctDNA positivity at 4 years had only a 20% four-year IDFS compared to 80% with patients who were ctDNA negative. So note that even in patients who are ctDNA negative, we're not seeing 95 or 100% four-year IDFS. The events are still happening in patients who are ctDNA negative. Again, they also showed some dynamics of ctDNA detection and association with outcomes. Clearly, the patients who were negative to begin with and stayed negative had the best outcome with a four-year IDFS of 87%. Patients who were negative or became positive or stayed positive really had pretty poor outcomes with four-year IDFS of less than 15%. And patients who were positive and then became negative did a little bit better than staying positive throughout, but still, you know, not a home run, 58% four-year IDFS. So even in this very high-risk population, which Monarch E was a very high-risk population, ctDNA detection rate with this tumor-informed assay was low, less than 10% at baseline and total 17%. The ctDNA detection was highly prognostic of worse outcomes, you know, begging the question that these patients need better and more effective therapies. The question is, when should these therapies be initiated and what should these therapies be? It is not known that if one acted at the time of ctDNA positivity, will it prevent the eventual development of metastatic disease or recurrence, or by the time we find the ctDNA positive, is the horse already out of the barn? Like, it won't matter what you do, the radiographic metastatic disease will occur regardless. Among patients who were ctDNA negative and stayed negative, this four-year IDFS was 87%. And to me, that is still not very robust. So I don't think we can de-escalate therapy based on ctDNA negative in this very high clinical risk group yet. The lead time from first ctDNA detection to IDFS event was relatively short and ranged from 6 to 7 to 15 months in each one of the four cohorts. What this biomarker study doesn't tell us is the impact of Abema plus ET versus ET alone on ctDNA clearance, since it was the pooled analysis of both the arms together.
So a two-part question. One is, do you use a ctDNA in your patients outside a trial setting? My guess is your answer is no. If it is no, I think a lot of people say that in breast cancer. What do you do when a patient brings in a result? You know, another doc's ordered it or whatever. They walk in. Do you like not look at it?
So the thing is, like, you know, we just, if it's a positive test from outside, we'll do a scan. If it's a negative test from outside, I tell the patients, like, they still need to do what they're supposed to be doing, because it's negative today, there's no guarantee it'll be negative in 3 months. Or it just, as you see, even in patients with negative tests at baseline, there's a 20% event rate at 4 years, which again, you know, is not something that we're all very happy about. Like, we would like that number to be much better.
You know, look, the subclinical control of disease is a pretty decent, it works in CML, you know, maybe yes. Someday, you know,
yes,
who knows?
Someday.
Who
knows? I think we're on the right track. So eventually, you know, we will get there. We're just not there yet. A lot of research is being done, so stay optimistic. So this is the INAVO 120 study, which evaluated a novel PI3 kinase inhibitor, inavolisib, which is highly potent and selective PI3K alpha inhibitor. It also promotes the degradation of mutant PI110 alpha, and which might improve the therapeutic window of this drug. We've known alpelisib has been on the market for a few years, but it's, you know, plagued by its toxicity and challenges in actually delivering it to patients. So this INAVO120 was an interesting trial. It focused really on a very high-risk patient population, those patients that developed progression during or within 12 months of adjuvant endocrine therapy completion, and randomized patients to receive fulvestrant with the CDK4/6 inhibitor palbociclib or the same combination plus INAVO orally every day. The PFS was the primary endpoint of the study. We saw at San Antonio a very robust 7.7-month improvement in PFS with the triple combination compared to the endocrine therapy plus CDK in this very high-risk patient population. At ASCO this year, we saw some more data about PFS proxy of PFS2, which was time from randomization to discontinuation of the line of therapy subsequent to INAVO or death from any cause. And we see that there's a sustained benefit beyond progression on INAVO in these patient population, which was also very reassuring to see. In terms of side effects, we saw the same side effects that we typically see with PI3 kinase inhibitors, but they were less intense for sure. Discontinuation rate due to AE was 6.2%, which compares very favorably to alpelisib studies. The side effects were the same of hypoglycemia, or diarrhea, or rash, but they tended to be more lower grade that the patients could tolerate. And the patient-reported data that was presented at ASCO suggested that the patients that received INAVO in addition to palbo fulvestrant experienced longer median time to deterioration in pain severity, and the addition of INAVO had no detrimental impact on physical functioning, role functioning, or other health-related quality of life measures. This is a promising new treatment options for patients who have a PIK3 mutated hormone receptor positive HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer who have progressed on their adjuvant endocrine therapy, which, you know, in this era will probably also include a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Can you give us a little bit more of a flavor for the toxicity of this compared to alpelisib?
So I think if I remember right, the discontinuation of alpelisib due to side effects was a little over 20%. It's the hyperglycemia tends to be a lot more in alpelisib, especially the higher grades, and diarrhea as well. The rash is pretty well managed with prophylactic and oral antihistaminics. So in clinical practice, that we have a good resolution for. Both of these drugs require a minimum A1C to get on. INAVO, I think, required a 6 or a 6.5. Even when INAVO is available, we can't just go and prescribe it to people who have uncontrolled diabetes or have high A1C levels. So that level of caution we still have to exert. But the discontinuation rate, you know, that's 6.2%, is very, very encouraging here.
So sorry to be so clinical, but I know people are going to think this, which is, you know, you made a very helpful comparison, but, you know, sort of qualitatively between alpelisib and INAVO, where does CAPI, as it's currently being given, you know, 3 or 4 days, you know, I'm not sure how to assess exactly, but where does CAPI fit in? Is it better tolerated than INAVO? I know they haven't been compared, but any take on that?
Cappy has a little bit more nausea, at least in my clinical experience. And the hyperglycemia is better because you are on and off schedule.
Right.
Yeah, so that makes it tolerable. I haven't seen much problems with rash because we prophylactically give antihistaminics to all patients. With the Cappy also, you can enroll patients, you can put on with uncontrolled diabetes or hemoglobin A1C.
Right.
I think for Cappy it might have been 7.5. So some of those things are going to be common to all of these drugs. Cappy, I think cross trial comparison is better tolerated than alpelisib, primarily because of its intermittent dosing, I think. If we scheduled alpelisib intermittently, it would probably have the same, you know, toxicity balance, but don't know if it will impact efficacy.
All right, please continue. Another great paper coming up.
It's coming up.
Love
yes,
it.
So this is, yes, second line endocrine therapy, right? Post-Monarch, much awaited results were presented by Dr. Kalinsky. So this was a trial that aimed to look at CDK post-CDK, and I'll get into nuances of it's not the same CDK post-CDK. These are patients who had disease progression on CDK4/6 inhibitor plus AI as initial therapy and were randomized to either receive fulvestrant plus placebo or fulvestrant plus abemaciclib, and investigator-assessed PFS was the primary endpoint. You can see the baseline characteristics of the patients that enrolled on this trial. 60% had received prior palbo as their CDK4/6 inhibitor, and about 35% had received ribociclib. A very small proportion had received prior abemaciclib. 70% of patients had been on their prior CDK therapy for more than 12 months. About 20% of patients had bone-only disease, and two-thirds had visceral metastasis when they enrolled on the trial. In terms of the results, investigator-assessed PFS showed a statistically significant improvement in PFS, although numerically looking, the difference doesn't seem to be very robust. Some of this is driven by the early drop-off in both the curves, right? You see about 20-30% of patients come off the trial very early within the first 2 months. 6-month PFS rates were 37% for the fulvestrant arm and 50% for fulvestrant plus abemaciclib arm. The overall response rate was 17% in the abema arm versus 6% in the fulvestrant arm. When they looked at efficacy by prior CDK4/6 duration, in terms of the hazard ratios, they're not much different, I would say, but clearly patients who've been on CDK4/6 inhibitor as in their first line therapy for more than 12 months do better and seem to derive numerically more benefit in PFS with, you know, the abema in post-CDK, CDK setting. So this is the blinded central review PFS, which was a secondary endpoint, and you know the hazard ratio is still supporting statistically the benefit from abema. Here, the numeric PFS differences are much more and appear more clinically meaningful. And these estimates were impacted by informatic censoring in about 51% of patients in the abema arm. So that might be the reason why the differences in the median PFSs are so much between investigator-assessed and blinded independent central review PFS. This is the first phase 3 trial to demonstrate benefit of continued CDK4/6 inhibition beyond progression on a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. We've seen results from maintained trial in the past that were positive, but the PACE trial with palbo, which was negative, the efficacy in post-Monarch was noted across the pre-specified disease group subgroups and regardless of the ESR1, PIK3, or AKT mutation status. Some caveats to consider. Overall, the efficacy was modest. It was statistically significant, but I would say it was modest for continuation of a CDK or actually switch of a CDK from palbo or ribo to abema. There's a 20 to 30% early drop-off in both arms because of disease progression, indicating that a good proportion of these patients no longer have endocrine-sensitive disease. Two-thirds of the patients in this trial received prior palbo, and at least in the subgroup analysis, benefit appeared much less in patients who were initially on ribo and then got abema as part of this trial compared to who were initially on palbo and then got abema as part of the trial. I do think it's an option for patients with disease progression. on prior palbo plus CDK4/6 inhibitors, especially the ones that have been on that combination for more than 12 months. And also if the patient's not eligible for PIK3CA or AKT targeted therapy in that setting, one may want to go to a targeted drug plus fulvestrant combination. Moving on to beyond endocrine therapy in a metastatic setting, this is a TROPION-Breast01 trial. We saw the efficacy results at ESMO this year earlier. This is a phase 3 randomized trial that compared chemotherapy of physician's choice to Dato-DX, which is a TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugate. The trial enrolled patients who had received previous 1 to 2 lines of chemotherapy and had exhausted endocrine therapy options previously. And the primary endpoints were PFS by BICR and by an OS. And you can see it by the Kaplan-Meier curve on the right. There was a statistically significant improvement in PFS in this trial. The OS data are still pending. What we saw at ASCO was quality of life analysis and time to deterioration in global health score. Quality of life, pain, and physical functioning were delayed in the Dato-DX arm compared to the investigator's choice chemotherapy. The patient-reported symptomatic AEs were generally consistent with the clinician-reported symptomatic data. So this is reassuring to see that this ADC outperformed chemotherapy, at least in terms of PFS, without any detrimental impact on quality of life. In fact, better quality of life, at least in a couple of domains. We're awaiting overall survival data from this study, and I think based on that, an FDA approval. Moving on to DESTINY-Breast06, which was presented in a special session at ASCO. This was also a much-awaited trial that looked at T-DXd in first-line setting in terms of chemotherapy and compared T-DXd to chemotherapy of physician's choice in patients with HER2-low hormone receptor positive advanced breast cancer. The trial also enrolled a smallish cohort of HER2, what they called ultra low patients. 153 patients were enrolled in this category. The trial screened a little over 1,300 patients and enrolled 866 patients. At least in the presentation, it was not clear the reasons for failure, whether it was the central HER2 testing or other reasons, it's not clear. HER2 ultra low was defined as something IHC of over 0 but less than 1. And in more elaborate terms, this would correspond with faint, incomplete membrane staining in less than 10% of tumor cells. A third of the patients that enrolled on the trial had de novo stage 4 disease. Among the treatment of physician's choice, 60% of patients received capecitabine and the remainder received one of the two taxanes. Approximately 90% of patients had received a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, so this is pretty in line with what our current practice patterns are. Median lines of endocrine therapy that the patients received was 2. 85% of patients had visceral disease, and only less than 5% had bone-only disease. So this appears to be a little bit more higher risk patient population than what we think of as a conventional hormone receptor positive metastatic patient population. The primary endpoint was PFS by BICR in HER2 low, and the secondary endpoints were PFS in ITT, which included both HER2 low and ultra low. So this is the primary endpoint, PFS in HER2 low, statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement in PFS. PFS was 8.1 months in chemotherapy of physician's choice and 13.2 months with T-DXd. And the ITT, which included HER2 low plus the 153 ultra low, showed exactly the same PFS difference between T-DXd and TPC. The PFS by BICR was pretty online with the PFS that was investigator assessed. Confirmed objective response rate was 57% with T-DXd and 31% with treatment of physician's choice. ILD was noted in 11.3% of patients, pretty consistent rate that we've seen across the other T-DXd trials. There were 3 ILD-related deaths in this study. Overall in the trial, there were 5 treatment-related deaths in the T-DXd arm versus 0 in the TPC arm. These are the overall survival data, which are not mature yet. A point to be noted that only 20 and 17% of patients respectively in the two groups received T-DXd post-progression. We do see some separation of overall survival curves, which is trending in the right direction, but this is not statistically significant. So in summary, T-DXd demonstrated PFS benefit versus TPS treatment of physician's choice chemotherapy in hormone receptor positive HER2-low metastatic breast cancer in earlier lines of treatment than what DB04 had shown. DB04 was after one line of chemotherapy. The results in HER2 ultra-low were consistent with HER2-low subgroup. One of the challenges is how do we report and get the HER2 ultra-low reporting in clinical practice. It's not really part of routine community clinical pathology practices to report this category. It's not a category that's CAP endorsed. So this will have to be, remains to be seen if the drug does get approval in the setting, how we will get this, these results. Overall survival data are pending. The rate of crossover was very low. I think one question that remains in all of our minds is, what would be the impact on overall survival if there's mandated crossover? So if you can get an oral chemo first and then IV later and have the same overall survival, what are the merits of taking it in first line setting? Nonetheless, it does provide an option for first line chemotherapy in patients with hormone receptor positive HER2-low breast cancer. And I think choice of therapy for an individual patient will still be based on their preference, disease burden, cost, and many other factors. A patient who has low disease burden with primarily bone-only disease, I'm going to be less likely to recommend an IV therapy as first line of chemotherapy. The capecitabine might make more sense there. But again, I think these are going to be our very nuanced decisions.
So I think one thing of great interest is who's eligible to receive T-DXd. I mean, there are so many different possible ways and times it can be used, but in terms of who, I guess my question, have you had any patients who are so IHC zero, so non-amplified that you just, even though clinically you would have liked to give them T-DXd, you could not, not just regulatory wise, but would you want to?
So I don't know that based on this trial, I would want to, right? The fact that about 30% of patients screened out of the study tells me that the central testing did something to identify patients who would benefit. Perhaps 80% of patients with hormone receptor positive disease have enough HER2 expression to benefit from the drug, but that means that 20% don't. And I'm not sure that I'd be in favor of giving an IV drug that has toxicity and toxicity that can lead to mortality in absence of data. So that's the part that worries me. Yeah.
Of course. But I mean, I'm talking about, and this goes to, you know, everything about the pan-tumor approval is, you know, the number one situation people are talking about is a patient who has zero options, has a good performance status, and needs a response. And I'm not saying what to do, but we're not talking about like first line or anything like that. We're talking about people who are out of options and still in good condition, but it's there's still a risk. So if there's no benefit, you know, you don't want to expose, you know, if they feel well, you don't want to give them toxicity too, right?
Yes. So I think, you know, fortunately we will be in a situation where we have multiple ADCs to choose from. So, you know, the TROP2 directed ADCs are not dependent on HER2 expression. And we've also seen the efficacy of second ADC in the sequence, no matter how you sequence them, give the TROP2 first, T-DXd first, the one you give second is less effective. So when we have more than one choices of ADCs, then I think choosing based on biomarker will also be more important, right? If I give T-DXd to a patient who has zero chances of responding and then situate the HER, you know, TROP2 ADC later, that patient will have even less resistance. So it's going to get more complicated, just like the second line endocrine therapy space. Once we have 2-3 ADCs approved, some for regardless of HER2-low, others just based on HER2-low. And we will have absolutely no idea how these drugs work when we sequence them. And is there an optimal sequence, right? So even for TROP2 ADCs, they are work regardless of TROP2, but they work better if you have higher TROP2. So perhaps, you know, maybe in the right world, the highest TROP2s should get TROP2 first, right? And the highest HER2s should get the HER2 ADC first and then alter the sequence.
As you might guess, we spent a lot of time talking about ADCs and a lot of different tumors. And without a doubt, the number one thing I hear everybody's talking about is sequencing. and resistance and all that. So
resistance,
that'll be totally different in a year or two.
Yeah. Well, we need sequencing studies, which unfortunately not many are being conducted.
And we have no clue about you wouldn't give a taxane after a taxane. We don't know what we're doing.
Right. Yes. And the thing is, the payload in all of these ADCs is a TOP2 or TOP1 drug, right? So they're the same class. They're maybe different, cytotoxics, but they're the same class. So who knows? It's a lot of uncharted territories, and we will all learn more in the next 3 to 5 years. We saw these updates from Destiny Breast 03, landmark trial, which showed impressive improvements in PFS and OS with T-DXd compared to T-DM1 in patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. We saw some updates in the overall survival at the ASCO meeting this year. So there's an absolute 10-month improvement in overall survival with T-DXd compared to T-DM1. And with this longer follow-up, no new safety signals were seen, which was reassuring. So of course, T-DXd in second-line setting is standard of care for our patients, which was established based on DESTINY-Breast03. DESTINY-Breast07, we saw the presentation from that trial, and this is a dose expansion interim analysis of two of the three arms. So this not really a randomized study. This trial was looking at safety and tolerability as their primary endpoints of combining, of giving T-DXd monotherapy in the first line setting and combining T-DXd with pertuzumab in patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. There was a in-between module that combined this with immunotherapy that has been previously presented. So what we saw in this this presentation was impressive objective response rates of 76% in first-line setting with T-DXd in HER2-positive breast cancer and 84% objective response rates of T-DXd plus pertuzumab. And note that these two arms are not compared. These are just independent cohorts. But these impressive objective response rates are certainly very encouraging. No new toxicity signals were noted when combining T-DXd with pertuzumab. And this really it looks very, very favorable for the DESTINY-Breast09 trial, which is ongoing. It's a first-line trial in patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer that compares the THP, which is the current standard of care, to T-DXd plus pertuzumab versus T-DXd. And we all eagerly await the results of DESTINY-Breast09. So this was a phase one study that was presented by Dr. Bawe looking at a SERD, imlunestrant, in combination with HER2 therapy with or without Abema in ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer. So this study has had multiple parts. This was a dose expansion part, cohort of Part C and E. Part C included patients who've not had any prior CDK4/6 inhibitor fulvestrant and had two prior HER2 therapies. And they were randomized to receive the SERD with trastuzumab or the SERD with trastuzumab plus the CDK. Part E was more for patients who were on maintenance therapy, had an initial response with taxane HP-based therapy, and these patients received the SERD along with their HP maintainers. This is a very small cohort of only 6 patients. The main, goals of the study, as given this was phase one, was toxicity. The most common toxicity with the SERD and trastuzumab and pertuzumab was diarrhea and arthralgias, but there were no grade 3 AEs that required dose modifications. The investigators concluded that the combinations were well tolerated and the AEs were consistent with known safety profiles of the single agents. And there were no drug-to-drug interactions with HER2-targeted therapies. So we wait to see other phase 2 studies with this combination. But this is expanding these endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitor to patients with HER2-positive, ER-positive disease. A little bit about the efficacy. Response rates were, some responses were seen. They were not very robust except for the arm that had both the CDK and the SERD in there, a small number of patients. But nonetheless, some preliminary anti-tumor activity was seen.
So my question is, obviously we have elacestrin out there. We have imlunestrin that you just talked about. I think there's another one, camizestrin. There's others, but those are the three I hear about. At this point, in terms of, I don't know, efficacy and general tolerability, are they more alike? Anything stick out? You know, it's like when you're trying to look at CDK inhibitors, is anything that sticks out? Also, combinability, like in this with other things, is that different? Or biologically, chemically, or are they different?
I think they're all being able to combine with the CDK. I know Cami has safety data with CDK and elacestrin's generating it. So I think overall they're fairly combinable with many other drugs, which is a good thing. I would say a lot more so than our PI3 kinase inhibitors have been. I mean, they're different classes of drugs. So, but, you know, comparing oral to oral drugs, you know, bad diarrhea doesn't seem to be a side effect of any of them, which tends to be one of our number one causes of needing to stop the drug. Neither is cytopenias. So I think we'll see a lot more of SERD combinations with different things, especially if in efficacy they're outperforming fulvestrant. So I see the SERDs replacing fulvestrant in many of these combinations.
Right. In terms of, again, what we know about these three right now, from your point of view, it's hard to sort of tell the difference at this point. Does it make sense to you? You know, when I was kind of flashing back on the original ATAC trial, you know, they had, I guess, anastrozole versus tamoxifen, but there was anastrozole and tamoxifen, just no difference. But now we have all these things, we're adding hormonal therapy. Theoretically, I mean, I think there's a little bit of benefit from SERDs, even if they're not ESR1. Am I right? Or not, right. not that much?
Yes.
So I don't know exactly what they're doing, but they seem to be pretty well tolerated. They combine with other stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. And they're moving into adjuvant.
Sounds like it's
going to
be part
space,
of a combination.
Right? Yeah.
It's going to become a new myeloma,
into the
you know?
The adjuvant space also, right? So, you know,
right.
Perhaps, yes. So they're perhaps as monotherapy, right? Unless we move it very early on with CDK. So I think there's applications in different situations. Overall, I think if they're more efficacious than fulvestrant, they'll probably be replacing fulvestrant in many different areas. At least for now, show good combinability with anti-HER2 drugs, you know, other endocrine therapies, drugs targeting PI3 kinase AKT pathway. So we'll see. Right now, we only have one approved.
They keep adding stuff and all, but you know, the other thing about myeloma, a lot of that's the blood work, and maybe adjuvant's going to start going. Into liquid, you know, maybe 5 years from now, we're going to be treating people subclinically. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think surely in metastatic, we'll get there first, because especially when we use these targeted drugs, right? So if you're targeting something with an SERD, your ESR mutant subclonal ctDNA keeps rising, then that means that you ought to be doing something different, right? Even if you try it under a clinical trial umbrella. So I find that in metastatic setting, we have a lot more actionable scenarios where we can study important questions.
Sense.
Yes, and it'll eventually get to curative setting, but the stakes are much higher in curative setting of stopping something, adding something, removing something, or substituting something. So we tread with caution there.
So let's go to my another favorite thing, ADC plus IO.
ADC plus IO, another one of my favorites.
All the time.
So this is
every day.
This is now moving on to the triple negative breast cancer. This was data was presented from I-SPY 2.2 trial. Their Dato-DX plus durvalumab cohort. Again, Dato-DX is TROP2 directed ADC. In the I-SPY 2.2, there are three blocks in therapy. The first block is investigational agents, which is what Dato plus Durva would be. It'll be in block A. Block B is standard drugs, but kind of more tailored towards the subtypes, the immune positive, immune negative, DNA damage response, positive or negative type subtypes. And the Block C is AC type treatment. So the data that was presented included 106 patients with HER2 negative disease that were enrolled on the Dato plus durvalumab arm. 64 of these patients had triple negative disease and 42 had hormone receptor positive disease. You will see that almost half of the patients with triple negative disease were noted to be in the immune positive subtype, which is consistent with what we have seen with many other studies and analysis that half or 60% of triple negative patients have immune upregulation. And about 40% of patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease also had immune positive subtype. So the interesting thing about how the 2.2 is designed is after the initial 12 weeks of the investigational therapy, in this case, Dato plus Durva, the patients have imaging and have a biopsy. And if on the biopsy, there's disease seen or there's indication that there'll be disease still left, they move on to the Block B. So in this arm, 66 patients or two-thirds moved on to Block B and only 35 could proceed to surgery after Block A. And then, you know, about 40% of patients from Block B also moved on to Block C, receiving AC chemotherapy. These are the pathological response rates. Note that these PCR rates also include treatment on Block B and C for a good proportion of patients. The overall pathological complete response rate in triple negative breast cancer was 44%. And this was not just with Block A. Like some patients, in fact, a good number of them got other drugs after that. In the hormone receptor positive subgroup, it was 18%. So the combination graduated only in the immune positive subtype, where a response rate of 65% was seen. This was the only subgroup where the threshold was met. These are the side effects, and we've seen other trials with Dato DXd, so no new toxicity signals were noted. Stomatitis has been noted with this drug and was seen in over 80% of patients, was grade 1 in majority of patients, with some grade 3s and 4s noted, rash, fatigue, nausea, ocular toxicity is peculiar to this ADC. It was noted in almost half of the patients. Again, was grade 1 in majority of patients. This does require pre-start ocular evaluation and evaluation ongoing during this delivery of the drug to make sure that proactive measures are being taken. So I would say in conclusion, the overall PCR rate was modest at 45%. And really, are these PCR rates good enough? We see PCR rates north of 60% with many other regimens. Similar to findings from many other trials, I-SPY 2.2 noted high PCR in immune-positive subgroup, but this has been noted before in NeoPACT and NeoEnd trials where PCR rate was actually over 70% in immune-positive group. So what should be the path forward for this? Perhaps a confirmatory trial in immune-positive group or some other way of investigating this drug. TROPION-Breast04 is currently ongoing. This trial is actually quite ambitious and is looking at Dato DX plus Durva and comparing that to the KEYNOTE-522 regimen with the idea that can ADC plus IO replace polychemotherapy plus IO in early stage triple negative breast cancer. This trial is currently recruiting. A BRAVE trial was presented. This was the first efficacy analysis presented from this trial. This was avelumab in early stage TNBC with residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy or patients who had high-risk disease and went to surgery first. The trial randomized patients to receive either avelumab or observation, since this was an adjuvant trial after completion of all other therapy. The co-primary endpoints was DFS in ITT or DFS in the stratum B, which was the larger of the two stratum. This was the post-neoadjuvant stratum of patients with residual disease. And what we saw that there was no improvement in DFS in the ITT or the post-neoadjuvant stratum. So this tells us the timing of IO in early stage triple negative matters. Neoadjuvant is likely more effective than adjuvant. And really these clinical findings are consistent with animal data that we've seen from a few years ago. And we've seen similar observation in other cancers like melanoma and even in breast cancer. trials with the negative IMPASSION trial results. SAC-TMT or MK2870 in TNBC, this was a phase 3 trial, the OptiTROP Breast-01 study that was presented. Again, the first efficacy analysis that we've seen from this phase 3 trial. SAC-TMT is another TROP2-directed ADC, like Dato-DX and sacituzumab, with a TOP1 inhibitor payload and a high drug-to-antibody ratio of 7.4. This trial enrolled 263 patients and randomized patients to receive either SAC-TMT or physician's choice chemotherapy. 66% of patients in the physician's choice chemotherapy arm received eribulin as their chemotherapy choice. Approximately a quarter of patients had had a prior PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor therapy. Median lines of prior chemotherapy were 2 to 3. The requirement was at least 2 prior chemotherapies for triple-negative breast cancer. Majority of patients had visceral disease, which would be expected for a triple-negative trial population. Progression-free survival was improved with SAC-TMT compared to chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.3.2 and an improvement from 2.5 to 6.7 months, so clinically meaningful improvement. Objective response rate was 45% with SAC-TMT versus 12% with chemotherapy, and efficacy was noted at all levels of TROP2 expression. Overall survival was also improved with SAC-TMT. A clinically meaningful improvement in overall survival was noted with SAC-TMT. In terms of toxicity, most common toxicity with SAC-TMT were hematological. In addition to neutropenia, there was also anemia with grade 3 anemia noted in 28% of patients, a low rate of ILD, and 44% rate of stomatitis. Dose reductions were needed in 25% and interruptions in 51% of patients that received SAC-TMT. So it was more in SAC-TMT arm than the chemotherapy arm. SAC-TMT demonstrated statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement in both PFS and OS compared to chemotherapy in pretreated TNBC. These improvements that we see are similar to what has been noted in the ASCENT trial, but that compared sacituzumab, govitecan, TPC. The safety profile of SAC-TMT kind of combines the two other ADCs. It has similarities with sacituzumab in terms of hematological toxicity and also with Dato-DX in terms of eye toxicity and stomatitis and low rates of ILD. The schedule of administration is every other week. Note that sacituzumab is given 2 weeks on, 1 week off, and Dato-DX is given every 3 weeks. We don't have any data on comparative efficacy of these three TROP2 ADCs in triple-negative breast cancer or sequential efficacy of these drugs. But this was a positive randomized phase 3 trial and may lead to approval of this ADC. So we'll have a second TROP2 ADC available to use. We saw updated analysis from TBCRC048 expansion cohorts. This is a phase 2 study of olaparib monotherapy in patients with metastatic breast cancer that harbor a germline PALB2 mutation or have tumor or somatic mutation in BRCA1 or 2. The investigators plan to enroll 30 patients in cohort of the PALB1 or 2 mutation and 30 in the somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutation. The primary objectives was to confirm an objective response rate of greater than 30%. The somatic BRCA1 mutation cohort enrolled 30 patients, but the germline PALB2 cohort enrolled a little less patients, but the DSMC agreed to close that cohort based on the efficacy. Majority of patients enrolled had hormone receptor positive disease in both the cohorts. In terms of objective response rate, 75% objective response rate in the germline PALB2 cohort and 37% objective response rate in the somatic BRCA1 or 2 cohorts. So both of the cohorts met the threshold of the design. Olaparib is an important treatment option for patients with germline PALB2 mutation or the somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutation. Further research is needed to predict responses in the somatic BRCA mutation setting, as monoallelic versus biallelic loss or ctDNA versus tissue detection might make a difference. But nonetheless, in a routine clinical setting, this is an important treatment option for these patients.
So a couple of follow-up questions, if I could, please.
Yes.
I would say that for quite a while, there's been, and I know you have interests outside of breast cancer too, but for quite a while in ovarian cancer, there's been this thing like somatic equals germline in terms of response. You know, and that's, you know, I don't know if they're, whether they have a lot of data or not. And, you know, I know here you don't have anywhere the volume that they have there. Do you think that it's going to play out that there really is going to be? Because it looks like there's a difference, but maybe it's numbers. But do you think that it will play out that somatic may not respond as well?
I think that's what this is suggesting. And there's biological rationale for it, right? So the somatic, if you have one allele loss versus two allele loss, will probably matter. Germline, you're already missing one allele, so you lose the other, and then you have cancer and all types of HRD. And I think the ovarian literature shows somewhat about the same. The other thing is the reversion mutations, right? So how they appear and when they appear under pressure of therapy might differ when you have a germline mutation versus a somatic mutation. The other factor about the somatic mutations, if you have a somatic mutation, let's say in BRCA1 or 2, or in breast cancer, at least somatic mutations in other HRD genes haven't translated in with response to PARP inhibitor monotherapy. Like somatic mutations, PALB2, CHEK or other genes haven't translated to response to PARP inhibitor monotherapy. So I think what coexists with these somatic mutations might matter also. Like if you have a somatic mutation, BRCA1 or 2, what coexists with it? Some tumors might have somatic mutations in other genes in the same pathway that might help the drug work better. And if you have somatic mutations in other competing oncogenic pathways, like if the tumor also has somatic, let's say PIK3CA or P10 mutation, that might be driving it more so than the somatic BRCA mutation. And if you're only hitting PARP, that might not work. So I think it's quite complex. Having said that, to get a 37% response rate in a metastatic setting with the monotherapy on a drug that is relatively easy to take, I think it's a good enough option compared with what all we have. Can we refine it with more translational studies? Absolutely.
Now, I just had two things I wanted to ask you about. One is, I don't know whether I'm out of the loop or not, but if you know, I'm just wanted to get a little bit of an Olympia update. Like, you know, it's been a while now since Olympia has been out there. There's an approval out there. Like, how has it actually played out in practice? You know, are we finding as many people as we think we would find? Or any thoughts about how it played out in your practice, how it is playing out in your practice?
I think overall, we're probably still missing germline carriers, BRCA1 and 2 carriers, especially the ones that have hormone receptor positive disease. I think the uptake of genetic testing in those with triple negative disease has been increasing. It's been recognized, you should test all your triple negatives, right? What happens is it's the patients with hormone receptor positive disease that, you know, maybe not, they're not that young, but, you know, have two or three family members. We forget to test them. The ones that present with de novo stage 4, de novo metastatic disease, right? Anybody that has metastatic disease should get tested just for candidacy for, you know, the two PARP inhibitors. Oftentimes, they may or may not get tested. So I do think that there's patients with, you know, germline BRCA 2 mutations specifically, because they tend to have hormone receptor positive disease that we might be missing. Once they're recognized and you know the mutation status, then pretty much all of them will avail a PARP inhibitor if they have metastatic disease. We still stick in hormone receptor positive disease, we still stick with our first line CDK4/6 because, you know, there's the survival differences and those are more robust. But then a second line therapy, I typically am looking at a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, I'm talking about adjuvant and post-neoadjuvant.
So, yes, so the adjuvant trial, we will see an update on overall survival on that in the upcoming few months. I'm part of the steering committee, so I know that. The adjuvant space, again, I think it's the same principle. Those with triple negative disease, we're testing. Triple negative, we should test, right? That's been in guidelines. So if they have a mutation, they have residual disease, we're prescribing olaparib. The good thing is patients who have a BRCA mutation also have high PCR rates with chemoimmunotherapy. So about 2/3 of them will have a PCR, will never need anything in terms of more additional therapy after surgery besides finishing their IO. The ones with the hormone receptor positive disease that have high clinical disease burden, like 4 or more positive nodes and other things, that might not be that young, I think we're probably missing testing some of these patients to identify candidacy for olaparib. It's gotten a lot more complicated now also with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, right? So if you have a germline BRCA carrier that has, let's say, 4 positive nodes, right? Are you going to prescribe them abemaciclib or are you going to prescribe them olaparib, right? For their adjuvant therapy after they've finished their chemotherapy in the hormone receptor positive space. And when faced with that question, my decision is to do olaparib first because that's just 1 year of therapy. I can do that concurrent with endocrine therapy. The EBMI can add at the 1 year, and you know, Monarch E and Natalie and all those trials allowed up to 12 months, right, for patients to get on these drugs. But I, as a community, I think we could do better in genetic testing, especially in community settings. At academic places, we're a little bit more equipped to, you know, have all the resources to do things, and in community settings that may or may not be there.
I guess I wonder whether or not there's kind of how widespread the understanding is in the community and everywhere else about, you know, essentially
the
this
adjuvant,
option,
yes,
and the situation. Let me ask you something. If we just focus on BRCA germline, just that, BRCA 1 and 2 germline, right. I mean, I know it's different based on the situation, but globally, what fraction of breast cancers does that represent?
About 5%.
5%.
So it's not a very high number. So in absolute numbers, it's still a lot of patients, right? But it's because it's germline testing, and historically it has, like, if it was just a test, like I could order when I order ALK, like mark a box on the form, that I would do it on every patient. But now if I have to sit and counsel the patient, record the counseling, and then, you know, deal with the repercussions of positive tests in terms of testing the family members, sending for screening, all of that, then it adds a lot more to it.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Sharma, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.